afternoon. You are tuned into Juno Afternoon here for Tuesday, the 12th of September of the year 2017. I'm Jeff Ryan. I'll be your host for today. We'll be talking with author Alexander Galitsky about his new book, Old Russia and Modern America. Carolyn Brown will be here with a preview of Thursday's League of Women Voters Municipal Candidate Forum. Malibu's first poets laurate, Ricardo Means Ibarra, will be here with a preview of his recording from his book, Beyond the Reef, and the Valley Library at 6:30 p.m. Jen LeBeau and Nancy Lanhart will be here to talk about art. We'll have Writer's Almanac, Burnout, Music and More today on Junior Afternoon. Well, the forecast for today, patchy fog. Partly cloudy skies predicted for tonight, and partly sunny weather expected for Thursday.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. A deal that stunned the pharmaceutical world could mean a bright economic future for the St. Regis Mohawk tribe in upstate New York. The tribe will try to use its sovereign status to protect the patent for a popular drug and get millions of dollars in the process. North Country Public Radio's David Summerstein reports.
The drug is the popular dry eye medicine Restasis. Its manufacturer, Ireland-based Allergan, wants to shelter its patent from challenges by generic drug competitors. So it's transferring the patent to the St. Regis Mohawk tribe and giving the tribe almost $14 million cash up front.
It's game-changing. It means that we can provide more than we're able to now for tribal members.
Dale White is the St. Regis Mohawk tribe's general counsel. He says the tribe believes its status as a sovereign nation will exempt the drug from cases brought to a federal patent board. If it works, the tribe could also get up to $15 million a year in annual royalties from Allergan. The tribe has also inked another patent-protecting deal with an unnamed technology company. White says the 13,000 tribal members hope this is just the beginning.
We have housing needs, we have health needs, we have education needs that every other Indian tribe has. So having the ability or opportunity that might come along with this business venture is life-changing for the tribe.
Critics call the deal an underhanded way for drug giants to avoid competition from generics that brings down prices for consumers. If the arrangement survives legal challenges, other companies could partner with other tribes to protect their patents, too. For National Native News, I'm David Summerstein in Canton, New York.
What was expected to be a two-day hearing on tribal sovereignty spilled into 3 days last week. The provincial government in British Columbia is appealing a landmark decision that reestablished hunting rights for members of a tribe who live on both sides of the border. Correspondent Emily Schwing reports.
In March, a provincial court judge ruled that Washington State resident Rick Desitel acted within his indigenous rights when he shot an elk in British Columbia because he's Sinexed. It's a tribe the Canadian government deemed extinct 6 decades ago.
What we're fighting about is really who exactly holds rights.
Attorney Mark Underhill represents Desitel and other Sinexed members whose ancestors relocated to the Colville Reservation in Washington. He says it's all about control.
If you've got a group of people who have rights, the province has to talk to them, and they can't just do what they want in that territory.
The government's lawyer cannot comment on the case. Underhill expects a final judgment from British Columbia's Supreme Court in late December. I'm Emily Schwing reporting.
Alaska's High Court has reaffirmed sovereign immunity. Reporter Jacob Resnick has more.
The Alaska Supreme Court affirmed this month that Native tribes have sovereign immunity from state courts. Last Friday's 19-page ruling upheld a lower court's decision involving a legal fight between two Juneau-based tribal governments over federal funds. The Douglas Indian Association claimed it was owed $1 million in federal transportation money after it left a tribal consortium. In 2015, it sued Central Council Tlingit and Haida Indian Tribes of Alaska, which managed the consortium. A state judge threw out the lawsuit, arguing that tribal governments are sovereign and couldn't be compelled to submit to the discovery process. But the Douglas Indian Association appealed to the state's highest court. That attracted the attention of other Alaska Native tribes because it tested sovereign immunity for tribes sued in state court. The Tanana Chiefs Conference of Fairbanks later filed a brief in support of Central Council's position. Attorneys for both tribes said the Supreme Court ruling settles the question of whether sovereign immunity extends to Alaska's courts. Central Council released a statement praising the court's decision, saying it, quote, protects tribes from the burdens of litigation. For National Native News, I'm Jacob Resnick in Juneau.
And I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced at the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios by Kwanic Broadcast Corporation. Funding is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, with support from the Public Radio Satellite Service.
Support by BNSF Railway, proud partners of the American Indian Science and Education Society's National Conference, September 21st to 23rd, helping prepare the next generation of STEM leaders. More at bnsf.com/tribalrelations. Support by Northern Arizona University, a university committed to serving Native American students, offering opportunity in every direction, in Flagstaff, at community colleges around the state, and online. Learn more at nau.edu.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Network.
It's 6 minutes past the hour, and you're tuned into June Afternoon here on KTUO News, Juneau. First guest in the studio is Alexander Dolitsky with his 12th book, Old Russia in Modern America, Living Traditions of the Russian Old Believers. Alexander, thanks for coming in today.
Good afternoon, Jeff.
So, first of all, what is an old believer?
Well, old believers is basically the Russian Orthodox group that separated, you know, from the Russian Orthodox in the 17th century during the schism period when the Patriarch Nikon introduce new changes in the rituals and in the books, and it was a large group of people, the mass group of people who basically refused to accept those inventions or changes, and so the schism just become.
Can you describe this, what the schism is?
Well, the schism is, the Russian word is a raskol, that in the church in the 1666, when in the 17th century, when new the rituals and the new changes and new corrections in the books, you know, took place, you know, that many Russian peasants, you know, refused to accept those changes. The major changes were to use two fingers or three fingers when they cross each other, you know, that others would be, you know, just to go clockwise or counterclockwise during the procession, and few others. You know, the major about eight different rituals.
This is the fourth edition of this book?
I'm sorry?
This is the fourth edition of this book?
Yeah, it's a fourth edition. We published before three editions that were out of print, and this one is published in collaboration with the U.S. National Park Service, and it's much updated and revised with the 22 illustrations, and, you know, I added about 8,000 words from the previous edition.
Who is it for?
Well, it's a scholarly book. You know, it could be for a general audience too. Of course, it is. But introduction, I discuss, you know, Darkhamian theory, evolutionary theory. Just try to put the Russian old believers' experience and example in the context of theoretical perspectives. You know, from anthropological and historic point of view.
Would you call this an academic book?
It is an academic book, but it is also the book that for a general audience, you know, the rational believers in Nikolaevsk, you know, they're not academicians or scholars, you know, but, you know, they like to read it about themselves.
Is the book written about old believers here in Alaska or throughout the world?
Well, the old believers, they live in Alaska, about 2,000 of those. It's difficult to estimate how many exactly because they move back and forth. In fact, about 6 months ago, I was introduced to rational believers in Kaska and then in the swimming pool. You know, they were here, at least one family. Around the world, they live in Brazil, they live in Chile, they live in South America, Australia, in Oregon, in Canada, and of course we have in Alaska, we have conservative group, mostly conservative group that settled in Alaska in early 1960s.
Describe some of the traditions that are being saved by...
Well, they mostly, the first of all, they speak the Russian language, and they have very unique a dialect of the Russian language that they kind of preserved. And the linguists, you know, they study, you know, their dialect, and oftentimes, you know, kind of their Russian language is mixed with English words, like they would say, "Oh, the Musa came," well, instead of loss in Russian, but Musa came and, you know, just ruined my garden or something like that. In their appearance, the clothing, they always wear, you know, the Russian clothes, the free the elements are very important, the cross, the belt, and the Russian shirt. So in the food, you know, they observed, you know, that they you know, the Russian food, you know, kind of traditional Russian food always in their family, and, of course, you know, religious practices.
Tell me more about the religion.
Well, the Russian Old Believers, they're basically Russian Orthodoxy, but, you know, they just follow the old tradition, old books. And many of them, there are many different fractions or factions, you know, of concords of Russian Old Believers. They mostly, you know, they divide into two different groups, priests and priestless, those who recognize the priest and those who do not. Those who do not, they're most conservative, and they, you know, pray and, you know, in the Malelny Dom or prayer house. And those who are priest group, you know, they have their churches. And there are about 200 days, you know, when they basically fast, you know, and they have many holidays that have to observe, 44 in their calendar. And on a Sunday, they go to church at 2 o'clock in the morning and basically, you know, they, you know, pray for a very long time. So religion determines their life. It determines their cultural values. It determines who is going to marry whom. It determines, you know, with whom they socialize, with whom they don't. And, of course, they develop a certain strategies, you know, how to preserve their traditions and their religious practices, like a boundary maintenance. They have elders, you know, who decide, you know, what they're going to accept and what they're going to reject in their villages. So the religion is a core, you know, that basically determines their values and their lifestyle.
What was your initial research aimed at?
But what started? Well, I started with Russian Old Believers in 1983. You know, I was working as an archaeologist in the Kenai Peninsula, and that's where they are. So I just made a visit in 1983. But prior to that, I applied to work when I was at Brown University to work with Old Believers in the year before. And I submitted my transcript from the Soviet Union, where there was a lot of scientific atheism and history of Communist Party. So the response I got from the Old Believers that Mr. Dolitsky is a full-fledged Marxist and non-communist, we don't want him around. So when I was in the Kenai, I basically just crushed in, and I didn't tell him that who I was before. And it was fine. You know, just the two fellows, Martyshev and Basurgin, they just took me around, and they showed me around, and that's how I was introduced. And then I visited Old Believers six or seven times after that. And I did the research.
Is it difficult for the Old Believers to mix in with modern society, or do they pretty much stay away from everybody else?
It changes a lot. You know, just recently was an article published in New York Times about a very conservative village, Voznesenka, in the Kenai Peninsula, and the Russian Old Believers, they play football. In 1983, they would not accept computers. There were no Russian books in their library. You know, no Tolstoy, no Dostoevsky, nothing of that. And, of course, they taught Russian language. You know, they had their own people. The school board was controlled, you know, by the Russian Old Believers. Things changes. Obviously, in the 35 years I studied them, you know, I seen them, you know, using their makeup. You know, sometimes, you know, they drink wine. They according to their traditions, they should not. They intermarry with a non-believer. And in the past, a non-believer should be converted to Russian Old Believers. Now it's not necessarily that. You know, in my time, when I went in 1980s, you know, they didn't have a televisions in their houses. Now they do. And, of course, they're not in competition of technology, but they were resistant to information that would penetrate into their household and influence their children. So there are changes. And but, you know, they're fishermen, they're carpenters, they're construction workers. You know, they used to work, you know, here in the Douglas. One family built a house, and I seen them in a swimming pool. The women were wearing shashmura, a little hat. But, you know, it would be unheard 30, 40 years ago for the woman to reveal themselves to the point that she can go to the swimming pool. So there are changes. And, you know, they socialize with the society. They love our democracy. You know, when they become citizens of the United States, and I believe in 1975, you know, they just praised the United States for giving this opportunity to exercise, you know, and practice their religion. And they were persecuted for years, for 350 years in Russia. And so that's why they migrated, you know, to China, from China to Hong Kong, from Hong Kong to Japan, Australia, and, you know, just many different places. And, you know, so, and they're in contact with those people because they have to marry their own, generally.
Did you just pretty much stick with Alaska for your research?
I did my research only in Alaska. When I was in Altai Mountains in 1990, I did archaeology. There's a Bukhtarmin, all believers lived there. Very, very remote village was settled during Catherine the Great because they refused to serve in the army. So I visited this in Altai Mountains, or all believers, they didn't want to talk to me. So I just kind of look at them, took some pictures.
But you want to talk about distance. And you'll be wanting to talk with a bunch of people who come down.
In all time out, I wanted to talk to a few people. They were reluctant, and so you don't push it. But in the Kenai Peninsula, you can see in my book, there is a photograph when I started kinship with a Kondratiev fellow. He passed away and many others. I took very pictures. My pictures are unique. They go back to 1983 when there is no Soviets were allowed to Alaska. So I said to our library, I'm going to donate next week all my collection of my photographs and notes to our archive. So in my book, the photographs of 1983, 85, 86, you know, that quite, and descriptions, you know, of that period of time. But of course they change. You know, we have about 2,000-3,000 Russian old believers in Alaska, and I metaphorically, I call them kind of Amish of Alaska, you know, so.
Is there any way you could compare the Amish and the old believers?
I tried, because when I was in Lancaster, I studied at Bryn Mawr College, did my PhD, work on a PhD program in anthropology, and was nearby. So just for the curiosity, I visited the Amish community. They don't know about each other, but they know they have many things in common. Amish are in competition of technology, as you know, at least in the past. The rational believers, they're not. They drive cars, they have washing machines, you know, and now they have cell phones and televisions. In the 1980s, they didn't. You know, so that's a big difference. But, you know, there's a great similarities, you know, for them. The appearance, the clothes, you know, is their identity. The language is their identity. They want to maintain those. And the food is their identity. You know, and I would say my brief observation of Amish was sort of the same. And they're both religious refugees. The Russian old believers are religious refugees. They came to Oregon in 1960s with intervention of Robert Kennedy, who was Attorney General at that time. And they settled in Oregon. There is a larger community in Oregon, in Woodburn, about 10,000 Russian old believers. So, you know, then the group came to Alaska, the conservative group, the first five families, because, you know, the pressure from outside, you know, they didn't want their children to do certain things, but what can you say, you know, they're influenced by that.
I'm talking with Alexander Dulitsky. He's the author of Old Russia in Modern America, Living Traditions of the Russian Old Believers.
And tomorrow is going to be the book signing at Hartside from 1 to 3 p.m., in downtown.
As part of their sidewalk series?
Yeah, the sidewalk series. It was 1 to 3 in downtown at the Hartside Books.
Alexander, thank you for coming by.
Thank you, Jeff.
And here is the Writer's Almanac for Tuesday, the 12th of September, 2017. It's the birthday of the man who asked that his epitaph read, "If after I depart this veil you ever remember me and have thought to please my ghost, forgive some sinner and wink your eye at some homely girl." Henry Louis Mencken, H.L. Mencken, born in Baltimore on this day in 1880. Popular journalist of his day, wrote about con artists and attacked chiropractors in the Ku Klux Klan, and most of all attacked Puritan morality. He called Puritanism the haunting fear that someone somewhere may be happy. And he wrote a book called The American Language, came out in 1919, a history and collection of American vernacular speech. It's the birthday of Irénée Joliot-Curie, born in Paris, 1897. She was the daughter of Pierre and Marie Curie, homeschooled as part of an educational experiment run by her parents and their friends called the cooperative, the adults, scientists, experts taking turns teaching one another's children. During World War I, she helped her mother operate mobile X-ray units in field hospitals, her mother Marie, who discovered radium. She began assisting her mother in the radium laboratory at the University of Paris, met a young chemical engineer named Frédéric Joliot. In 1935, the two of them won the Nobel Prize in chemistry for artificially creating radioactive elements. And then, like her mother, Irénée Joliot-Curie developed leukemia as a result of her close work with radioactive substances and died at the age of 58. And it was on this date in 1846, Elizabeth Barrett and Robert Browning eloped. They'd been courting in secret for a year and a half through the mail, unbeknownst to her father. It all began when Robert Browning wrote Miss Barrett a fan letter saying, "I love your verses with all my heart, and I love you too." And she wrote back to him. She was an invalid. She was a heavy user of morphine. Her father did not approve of Browning. They were married on this date in 1846. She went back home afterward, stayed for 1 week, then ran off to Italy with Browning and never saw her father again. Here's a poem by Corey Messler. "Last night I was a child again in Raleigh. Last night I was a child again in Raleigh, and the Dorrich boys were on the roof, and my sister was waiting behind the Monopoly board, and it was summer, and the heat was like a separate personality, and dogs wandered here and there unhindered by fences or leashes, and I could see how my future spread out before me like a relief map without relief, and I only wanted to fit in again, to find my family intact, scamp, still alive, and my father regal in his recliner, an ashtray full of cigarettes near him, and I wanted to say, 'Father, stop now, stop, please, let this not be dream, let it be true, that I am a child again in Raleigh, under the finest sun anyone had ever seen, never to be seen again.'" A poem by Corey Messler, "Last Night I Was a Child Again in Raleigh," from his collection Among the Mentions, published by Iris Press and used by permission here on the Writer's Almanac, supported by Home Advisor, matching homeowners with background-checked professionals for home projects from minor repairs to major remodels. See homeowner reviews, compare prices, and book appointments at homeadvisor.com. And by Magoosh, online test prep for the ACT, SAT, GMAT, GRE, LSAT, and MCAT. Prep smart, go far, and enjoy the ride at magoosh.com. Be well, do good work, and keep in touch.
Support comes from Southeast Radiation Oncology Center, featuring the third annual Patient Appreciation Luncheon on Thursday, September 14th from 11:30 until 1:30 at 1701 Salmon Creek Lane. Reservations at 586-5762 or southeastradiation.com.
Something else happening on Thursday is the Juneau League of Women Voters Municipal Candidate Forum. In the studio with us today, we have President Chris Meany and Vice President Karen Brown. Thank you for coming down to the station today.
Our pleasure.
So before we go too much further, can you tell me a little bit about the Juneau League of Women Voters, please?
Sure. Well, we're a group of men and women, both, actually, and we want to make sure that people are registered and that they're informed about voting. And so a lot of the work that we do tries to inform the public so that they can be an informed public and actively participate in our government. It's very important.
And you're hosting the Candidate Forum, which you've done for a number of years.
Yes. The Candidate Forum is on Thursday, September 14th, And starting at 6:30, there'll be a meet and greet the candidates, and we'll have some snacks there. And then the actual forum will start at 7 o'clock, from 7 o'clock till 9. And we will first have the school board candidates. There are three candidates running for two positions. And then they will have an opening statement, and then they'll be asked questions, and then there'll be a closing statement in that sequence. And the audience will get a chance to ask questions. We'll have index cards there. So if you have a candidate that you would like to ask questions of, come and write it down on our index card, and we'll see if we can get it answered for you. After the school board candidates talk to us, then we're going to have the assembly members, the candidates for assembly. And there are seven people running for three candidates. For three seats on the assembly.
That'll keep you busy. This is going to be broadcast on KTUO.
Yes, we're happy that that it will be broadcasted as well. So if you can't come down and be there in person, then please listen in on KTUO.
Anything else you'd like to add?
Well, there will be a voter's guide coming out in the Juneau Empire on Sunday, September 17th. That will have a lot of information about the candidates. They'll have some questions that they'll answer on the voter's guide as well. And
if a person really wants to know about the candidates, the skinny is on the website for CBJ. So if they'll go online to CBJ and go through all the little items, and they'll come to the elections and they'll see all the stuff that they want to about the candidates. But it will be in the Empire on Sunday, we hope, as well.
Do you know off the top of your head what percentage of voters actually vote during the election?
About a third, I guess.
Well, it depends on the election. As you know, in the last one, it was about a 50%, I think, in Alaska. But sadly, in our last municipal election, it goes to about, I hardly want to say it, 20%. And if you start looking at that, 20% of the eligible voters decide for the 100% of eligible voters, because those are the people that show up and vote. So one of the biggies that the league gets involved in, not only do we register people to vote, which is going to become easy with the PFD rules when they get in place, but our job now is to get people engaged so they know the issues, they know who the candidates are, which they can learn if they'll do it. But you got to put shoes on and show up, so that's our big job now.
And you don't even have to wear shoes.
And the actual election day is October 3rd, and if you can't vote on the 3rd for some reason, we have early voting. And there are two sites in Juneau for that, at the City Hall, second floor conference room, starting on September 18th through October 2nd, or in the Mendenhall Valley at the Mendenhall Mall Annex, same date, September 18th through October 2nd.
And in case anybody missed it, is there a place that this is online?
What was the question?
Is it available online?
Yes, I think we can vote online now, yes. I was just talking with Josie Banky last week about that, and they're undergoing a lot of changes to streamline this and to make it even better. Since I haven't voted online, I can't promise you that I know the full answer to that.
Yeah.
But if they will go to Division of Elections and look under Elections, it's all there. It's all there.
All right. Chris Mimi, Carolyn Brown, is there anything you'd like to add?
I guess I'd like to brag about the League of Women Voters in Juneau. The state League of Women Voters has four different groups in Anchorage, Fairbanks, and Kenai Soldotna. And Juneau, we're the largest. We have 140 members. We have men, women. We have a lot of young people, and we're involved in many, many different activities, including getting kids to the Capitol, voter registration. We have our lunch and learns at the different places in town where we have forums and actually present things. And then obviously we are at many forums registering to people and walking in parades and handing out all of the information that we can. So we're busy people.
All right. Thanks so much for coming down.
Thank you for asking us.
Thank you.
This is Bird Note. Some cloudless night in September, when the air is clear, take a seat outside. Turn your binoculars to the sky. With patience and a bit of luck, you may see birds flying across the yellow face of the moon. September is peak migration time for millions of songbirds heading south from temperate North America to more tropical latitudes. Most migrate at night. Orioles, warblers, sparrows, and tanagers. Nocturnal migrants of the same species call as they fly, enabling flockmates to stick together. Many of these flight calls are distinctive, enabling those with an excellent ear or good recording gear to identify them as they pass. Like many nocturnal travelers, the Swainson's thrush avoids predators by flying at night, because hawks migrate during the day. But mostly, night migration's attractive because the cooler, more stable air makes flight more efficient and prevents overheating, meaning that even a tiny bird, like a warbler, that weighs around a third of an ounce, can cover as much as 200 miles in a night. Your Moonwatch vigil may reveal only a few dozen such birds on the move, but researchers along the Gulf of Mexico have tracked more than a million birds headed to Central America on one busy night.
Brewfest is coming. K2 is proud to sponsor the Rotary Club of Juneau's 6th annual Capital Brewfest, Saturday, September 23rd from 1 to 5 at the Jack. Come enjoy great beer, live music, and fantastic food. All proceeds support the Juneau Housing First Collaborative and the humanitarian projects of Juneau Rotary. Tickets are limited and will sell out, so don't wait. Tickets available now, online only, at capbrewfest.com.
It's 32 minutes past here, and you are tuned into Juneau Afternoon. Our next guest is Ricardo Means Ibarra. He's the Malibu First Poet Laureate. Also in the studio with us from the Friends of the Library is Beth Weigel.
Thanks, Jeff.
Thank you for coming down.
Thank you.
So we're excited to have Ricardo here in town to do a poetry reading tonight at the library, at the Mendenhall Valley Library at 6 p.m. We have you scheduled, I believe.
Love it.
Yeah, so we're excited to have you here. I know you came to us through a little bit of a local connection. So tell us about how you got here to Alaska and what you might be reading poems about tonight.
Okay, so 42 years ago, I met the Spengler family in Santa Cruz, California, and they took me in, and it's been 25 years since I've seen Larry Spengler and Tim Spengler, who are up here, who live here in Juneau, of course. And I like to tell people that I have been planning on coming to Alaska for 42 years, and so I'm pretty excited to get here finally and read some poetry.
Now, Malibu's first poet laureate. Can you tell me how you first got into poetry and how you became the poet laureate?
First getting into poetry, that was about 30 years ago, and that was what I call a beautiful stumble. I just fell into it, and with an incredible mentor by the name of Benjamin Saltman, an incredible poet. And, one of those things where you fall into it and you feel like you've been blessed. Okay, this is something that speaks to me, and this is an art, a creative form that I enjoy and I love, and I think I can write a good poem every now and then.
What makes for a good poem?
Well, what makes for a good poem? I think, you start out with an idea, and then you slip into what you really should be writing about. Maybe we could call it the unconscious, or you find what I like to call the marrow, and it's a surprise though. And the best art, I think, is a surprise when it comes at you and it takes over. And those are my best poems, my favorite poems. And, they're rare. I have a few gems. I'll read you a few tonight. Yes.
I feel like when I was when you sent me the description of some of your poetry, mm-hmm. you had a lot of really interesting characters, that were animals as well as real characters? Is that one of the things that drives some of the poetry that you're writing, is sort of a character base or a place base? How's that?
You know, I like to tell a story mm-hmm. with my poems, and I like it. I hope that they're accessible, and I think they are. I think people can get and follow along with the story real easy. And underneath, sometimes there's some currents floating around under there that there might be some other meanings that I haven't slipped them in, but they're just there naturally. All art seems to have a couple different meanings, not just what you see or what you hear.
How did you become the poet laureate of Malibu?
Well, that was a selection process, and at first I thought, oh boy, I don't know if I'm up to this task and whether I should even apply for this. But I enjoy working with children. I'm a workshop volunteer poet with writers in the schools, and I enjoy working with children. And I thought, you know, we're trying to elevate the arts and culture in Malibu. And that it's always been known as a Hollywood town. It's got a little bit of a vapid outlook. People always think of us just as that little strip on the beach and the sand where all the lovely people are living. But there's the whole other side, on the other side of the highway, where the rest of us live. And we're pretty much normal people. And we wanted to create more of an artistic area and creative area. And so a poet laureate seemed to be a great idea. You know, any way that we can put the arts out to the public, and poet laureate is definitely one of them.
And how long of a term do you serve?
2 years. 2 years. But I have loved it. It's been about 6 months, and I've loved it. And,
what do you have to do?
Well, let's see. I did a fascinating, we had an installation of the kites of Tyrus Wong. Tyrus Wong was a Chinese-American. He just died recently, but he was 106 years old. Chinese-American who was the Bambi artist at Walt Disney. But, of course, he didn't get any credit, or he got very little credit, and he was the main artist. And after he retired, he didn't stay with Disney, but he continued as an artist cartoonist. I'm sure there's a more proper word. He began to build kites, beautiful kites. And if you can imagine like a centipede with 30 different segments, and each one was a kite, little tiny kite, small kite, and he would fly them down at the beach. And we had a photography display of the kites as well as his kites there. And I got some of the fifth graders together to write some poems on the kites. They brought another Chinese-American poet in from Singapore, who was originally from Singapore, and a violinist. And it was really a beautiful, beautiful little show. Yeah.
How do you find the poem in an assemblage of words?
How do you find a poem? Well, that's another. I stumble into my poems all the time. I start off with an idea, and usually the goal, leads me somewhere else. And when that does, when it speaks to me, then and takes me into that other area, then I find that those are my favorite poems.
A lot of your poems use free verse. Talk about free verse, please.
And I bring, I know you talked about animals. It seems like I have a lot of animals in my poems. And it was funny. The first poem that I'm going to read tonight was, and I was thinking of this before I came up when I was still in Malibu. And I was thinking, this is fun to think about. What are you going to read? And I was very excited about coming up here. And so I thought, you know, I should read them a poem about an exciting location with a lot of animals and rain. And then I came up here, right? And I was, oh, this is hilarious.
Yeah.
What is that irony or what?
I feel like you also sent us some copies of your latest book of poetry, Beyond the Reef, but you also have some other children's
Books. The first one was published by Arte Publico, and that was called Scratch and the Pirates of Paradise Cove. Scratch is a cat with six toes, so and the little boy that loves him, and they have quite some adventures. And the second one is a follow-up, Scratch and the Space Invaders.
Can you please read a selection of one of your poems, please?
Oh, I'd love to. Okay. So, I thought I would read a Malibu poem. Why not? And it's called Swimming Laps. I'd like to tell you a little bit about it. So, I like to swim laps for exercise at the local pool, which happens to be in our high school, Malibu High School pool. And every day, every time I'd go swimming, I'd see a fellow there. He happened to be an urchin diver, and he'd had some kind of horrible back injury, and he'd be there doing rehab. And I thought, gosh, I got to write a poem about this guy. I mean, I admire him so much. And I try writing these poems about this fellow and his back injury, but nothing sounded good. It sounded like I couldn't find him. And then one day I was swimming across the pool, and I looked down, and I saw a Band-Aid floating in the water, and I had my poem. So here it is, Swimming Laps. He dives for urchins in the high school pool. Brace discarded, broken spine left on the coping. Rakes the reefs of the Channel Islands, Santa Cruz, Rosa, and San Miguel. Fills freezer bags with roe. I swim 20 minutes maximum, a slow crawl. Hands slap the kick turns, finish with two laps of backstroke. We acknowledge each other every other day in the pool. He waves at me. I wave at him. We fix our goggles, and while I check my starting time, he begins his search. Miles of laps to the islands and back. Then the struggle to hoist himself out, tighten the Velcro straps of his brace, gather his fins, earplugs, a kickboard. Even though he chides my lackluster workout, I swim near him in the shallow lanes, not the deep end of the pool. In the deep end, I lose concentration, wonder at the flesh-colored Band-Aids clinging to the bottom, depleted blood cells, a hoop earring, the currents below. Once I forgot to breathe, forgot the time allowed, lost my rhythm, two strokes, head up, gulp air, and began to slide under the burdenous surface, down strands dense with kelp bulbs, flat, spiny leaves, down beyond the reef, down to the safety of smooth, white plaster.
That's poetry of Richard Means Ibarra. He'll be speaking tonight at the Valley Library, we think about 6 o'clock or so.
Great.
Thank you.
What's harder, starting a poem or finishing it?
Oh, finishing it. Because they never finish. I can play with them and play with them. I get to where I believe, okay, this is a good ending. I'll give it another, day or so and look at it again. But they're never done. They are never done. You can always play with them a little bit more.
Anything you'd like to add before you...
No, I thank you so much for having me here on the
radio. Juno afternoon, yeah. We'll look forward to seeing everybody tonight at the Valley Library around 6 p.m. Visit with Ricardo.
Great. Thank you, Beth.
Juno's hottest diva sing-off is back. Join Juno Lyric Opera on September 23rd for Hoosier Diva, the show featuring some of our city's most talented singers duking it out under the spotlight. Your dollars vote for the best attitude, voice, and glitter these singers can bring to the stage. For tickets and to vote for your top diva, visit www.junoopera.org.
¶¶ And as bad as I want to walk into the boss's office and say that wrestling is not a legitimate sport, and I'm losing because he's writing scripts that tell me to lose, I don't. Because it's actually a good job, a dream job. And I'm happy to lose. And I don't mind that my knees hurt, my everything's hurt, because I'm one of the wrestlers, and I'm in love with who I am.
The elaborate entrance of Chad Deity at Perseverance Theater runs September 14th to October 7th. Tickets at ptalaska.org, The Jack, and 463-TIXS.
It's about 11 minutes before the hour, and we're tuned into Juno Afternoon. Our next guest is Jen LaRue. She's the Education Director for the Juno Arts and Humanities Council. She's here to talk about any living child.
Any given child in Juno, Alaska. Hi, Jeff. Thanks for having me. I wanted to share some things that Any Given Child Juno is sponsoring this week. This is National Arts and Education Week, and we have had a proclamation by the mayor done by Assemblywoman Mary Becker yesterday in the mayor's office. They made a proclamation claiming this week as the Juno Arts and Education Week. So we want to thank the mayor's office and the assembly for the support on that. Recognition of this week, we've done some. Any Given Child Juno has sponsored some activities. One started last week. It was the Principal's Luncheon that we co-sponsored with First Lady Donna Walker and Lieutenant Governor Byron Mallott and Tony Mallott. We were able to welcome 11 local principals to the mayor's, or to the governor's mansion for a luncheon, just to honor principals and all their work they do for arts in the schools. And we were very pleased to have honored guest Ernestine Hayes attend and give some remarks on her perspectives, which was very enlightening and empowering to all of us present. So we want to thank Ernestine also for her direction for all of these folks. She says we are the people to make the changes. We also are inviting all Juno School District teachers to participate in this week by engaging in the arts with their students and capturing that in photos, either of the students' artwork or of the students doing art, and sharing those photos with us so we can create, we're hoping to create a collage that we can share with the community and also use on the new Any Given Child Juno website that we're preparing to launch in this fall. So I wanted to share those things, but also just talk a little bit about Any Given Child Juno and what it is. So Any Given Child Juno is sponsored through the John F. Kennedy Center for the Performing Arts. In 2013, Juno was selected as the 11th Kennedy Center selection for this program. And what it is kind of a collective impact initiative where we bring together key stakeholders in the community. Superintendent Mark Miller is involved, and Ted Wilson with the Teaching and Learning Department at the school district, as well as other school district employees. They're very key members in this initiative because the effect is to be in the schools where we find all students. And so it's a combination of working with the schools as well as with the city leadership and other businesses and philanthropic groups in Juno, and pulling everyone together with arts and cultural organizations and trying to get everyone to come together and come to some understanding of what is happening in the schools as well as what needs to be happening in the schools for arts education.
What are some of those things that are needed?
Some of those things that are needed are to ensure that it's equitable access for all children. So where some students maybe get to have a teacher that feels very strongly about music and uses music a lot in their classroom, other students may have a teacher that isn't inclined or comfortable in that manner. And so that's just one example of how we're trying to look at what's happening in the schools and ensure that there is equitable access so that all students are getting a chance to experience and learn in and through the arts. Another part of Any Given Child is that we have three main goals. One is community engagement, to engage the community in being advocates for arts education. The other is arts learning, so that students are able to learn through the arts. We know that when children are engaged creatively, they are more resilient and able to grasp concepts and ideas. When they're engaged in learning through the arts.
I see you're going to be involved in some Clan House storytelling.
Yes. We have a program called the Arts Excursions, and we have currently set up three. The goal is to have every grade level from K through 8 get an annual excursion to have an arts experience, either in the community or possibly in their classroom for the younger kids. So currently we have three excursions that are ongoing, and we're adding another one this year. The first one is in November, and that's all second graders attending storytelling and information on the regalia that's housed in the gallery at the Walter Soboloff building. So all second grade students go to that. This will be the third year, I believe, that they'll be going there. And then fifth graders have been going to the Juno Symphony for many, many years. But 2 years ago, the symphony partnered with Any Given Child. And the effect of partnering with Any Given Child is to ensure that every single fifth grader gets to attend and that it is through the school district's influence, the administration is honoring this and requesting that all teachers participate. So every single fifth grade student gets to come and participate in this really cool interactive program that the symphony has paired with the Carnegie Hall Link-Up program. And so last year, it happens in February, and last year every student came in with some type of instrument, either a recorder or a banjo or a mandolin. And they all got to play along with the symphony.
It sounds like you captured the kids' spirit and fun.
Yes, it was really great. Next year, though, I hope we leave the lights up so I can get some good photographs. And then the third one is all eighth graders get to go to a theater performance. We've partnered with Perseverance for 2 years, and this year we're looking forward to partnering with visiting company out of New York called Ping Chung and Company. And this is a connection through Ryan Conroe, who most people in Juno are familiar with. Ryan, he's been working in New York City, and he's bridging a connection between New York and Alaska with some projects through Ping Chung and Company. So will be bringing eighth graders to a performance that they're going to be bringing to town in March. Yeah, and so then the newest one we're going to be adding this year is for sixth graders. We've partnered with the Juno Dance Theater, and they are going to bring all sixth graders to see their spring showcase and get to have some dance influence in the lives of students. So we're looking at filling in some of those gaps where there are K1, 3, 4, 7. Those are the grades that we still have to work for. And we're hoping to have arts organizations in the community come forward and show interest in partnering with us to match up some more excursions for those grades that are in development.
General, anything you'd like to add? You've got a lot of stuff that you're taking part in.
Yeah, there's another aspect I wanted to mention about Any Given Child. There's something called the Community Arts Team, which is really like the kind of the overall membership of where this project finds its guidance and input. And we're having another Community Arts Team meeting in October on the 9th at the Valley Library from 4 to 5:30. And we look forward to bringing the team together again to continue talking about the priorities for arts education in our town.
Is there something online people can find out more information about this?
Currently there's some information on the Arts and Humanities Council website under Any Given Child, but we are preparing to launch an anygivenchildjuno.org website by the end of the month. You can find that currently online, but it's still under construction. But the site is live. That website is active. So you can bookmark it and come back and visit it by the end of the month. Should have a lot of new information.
All right, Jen, thank you very much for coming in today.
Thanks, Jeff.
Weather forecast for tonight, mostly cloudy skies. Shelley Delaney will be your host on June afternoon tomorrow.
This is KTOO Juno. We broadcast at 104.3 FM in downtown Juno and Douglas. We also rebroadcast on